Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the program, after the recent death of a dog who was caught in a snare on public land, some residents of Fremont County are changing their dog walking habits.
You get this sense of living in fear, and it's like, you know, I don't want to sit in my house and live in fear.
Gillette is facing a new future with the decline in coal, but it's not the first coal capital or Wyoming town to watch coal disappear and have to figure out a new path forward.
There was an expression then that you could shoot a cannon down Broadway or the main street in Rock Springs and not hit anybody.
And two former residents of the Wyoming Girls School sat down to talk with how their paths affect their desire to stay in Wyoming.
I definitely think being sent 7 hours away from your hometown can, like, change your perspective on it a lot.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney is seen as a rising star in the GOP, so some in the party were surprised to see her opt to stay in the House and not run for the state's open U.S. Senate seat. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington on what some of her colleagues are saying about her.
After serving just one term, Cheney was propelled into the number three leadership position for Republicans in the House, where she helps run the party's messaging. Since Cheney is a household name in Wyoming and elsewhere, many political watchers expected her to run for retiring Senator Mike Enzi's seat, especially since Cheney tried to seek that seat a few years back before bowing out. Now, Cheney says her place is in the House.
I think I can have a bigger impact for Wyoming in the House, and I love the House, so I'm glad to be staying here.
When Cheney told House Republicans of her plan in a closed-door meeting, she apparently received a sustained standing ovation. One of President Donald Trump's top allies in the House is Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida, and he says she's the right fit to represent the party these days.
Liz is an asset in the House. She is very compelling as an advocate for the positions that the conference takes, and I know a lot of folks in the House, myself included, think highly of her.
While Gaetz adores President Trump, he also says he wouldn't be surprised if the nation had a President Cheney someday.
I think Liz could be president one day if she wanted to be.
But Cheney has her critics. She has a more hawkish stance on foreign policy than most, including Trump. And some conservatives say Cheney's helping the party betray its core principles, especially on fiscal policy, now that the nation has an annual $1 trillion deficit under Trump. That's why Michigan Congressman Justin Amash left the GOP and is now an independent.
Republicans change their stripes from day to day, so I'm not sure policy really matters that much to people in the age of Trump on the Republican side.
Is she emblematic of that?
Yeah, in some sense. I don't think it matters whether you're a hawk or a dove or fiscally conservative or fiscally wasteful. I don't think anyone cares on the Republican side right now.
Cheney's loudest critics come from the left, especially from New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other three freshman female minorities known as the Squad. Ocasio-Cortez says Cheney, who has repeatedly sparred with members of the Squad, dog whistles to the party's far-right base.
She certainly doesn't dial back on some of the horrifying rhetoric that targets us in the party, particularly young women of color, particularly immigrants, certainly not part of making the party more welcoming to more Americans.
Ocasio-Cortez says Cheney is merely being paraded about by party leaders because they know the GOP has a woman problem.
The party really struggles with women, and trying to kind of elevate a woman, I think, is an effort in having representation in their leadership. But most of her policy stances are atrocious and pretty horrible for working families and the environment. What else is new, though? That doesn't differ too much from the rest of the leadership of the party.
Still, some Democrats speak highly of Cheney. California progressive Ro Khanna is a Bernie Sanders supporter, yet he says Cheney has always been cordial to him.
You know, she sent me a book in our first term signed by her and Vice President Cheney and said, you may not agree past page three, but we're all on the same team. So obviously we have very strong philosophical disagreements, but I've actually found her to be respectful in debate.
But to most rank-and-file Republicans, Cheney is a rock star, and not just because of her dad. Here's Tennessee Congressman Phil Rowe.
Obviously, we have great respect for her dad, but she's done this on her own. She earned this, and I think she'd do a great job in leadership. He is doing a great job in leadership, and I think, I don't know where the top is.
Rowe even brought Cheney down to speak at a Lincoln Day dinner in his southern district.
It was kind of funny. She was running behind a little bit and got a speeding ticket coming up. I agreed to pay for it, but she wouldn't take the money.
As his constituents were waiting in line to get their photos taken with Cheney, some of his voters were eagerly asking about Cheney's future in the party. And Rowe says they were as excited as he was about what her future holds for the GOP.
I think the sky's the limit for her. I really do.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When you think about moving to a different state, the local housing market and the cost of living are probably high on your agenda. But for some conservatives living in blue states, it's also about finding redder pastures. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, one real estate company has turned that into a business model.
April Poley is a broker and real estate agent in Gillette, Wyoming.
I graduated from University of Michigan and then a week later got married and 2 days later moved to Wyoming.
Lately, she's been getting a lot of her potential clients through a fairly new business called Conservative Move.
Really, it's a referral service. You know, people go through that website, they say what states they're interested in, and then if they mention Wyoming, they get forwarded on to me.
Poley says what she hears is pretty consistent. Usually, they're looking for somewhere high on Second Amendment rights and low on taxes.
And they just feel like Wyoming might be a little less, we're a little bit more where we just let people do what they want to do. Just you do your thing and I'll do mine kind of attitudes around here.
Conservative Move was founded in 2017 by Paul Chabot after he and his wife left California for Texas.
When we arrived, we realized that so many people had made the move obviously long before us, but also for the exact same reasons. So we found our neighbor across the street was from California. My postman was from Long Beach, California. The guy at Home Depot was from Orange County.
Chabot says he and his wife came for the conservative atmosphere, and that's when they got the idea.
So we then decided to create a business based on that model of helping families move out of blue states and into red states. And the business literally blew up overnight.
Chabot says there are agents just like April Poley across 40 states, including the Mountain West. Often these agents just give initial advice on the move. But if they help someone sell their house and or buy another in their new red community, Conservative Move gets a percentage of the agent's commission. Chabot says he knows his business isn't without controversy.
People will say, well, moving really isn't political. I disagree. And it's not about political ideology or which way you lean. It's that everything is impacted in this world, in this country, in our cities and states by political decisions made by those that are elected.
But does this create an us versus them dynamic? Zach Taylor thinks so. And he says,
if you sequester any demographic, any political, any kind of identity, you know, issues, it does tend to make them more radical.
Taylor teaches political science at the University of Wyoming. He says it's no secret that the country is very politically divided, and a service like Conservative Move reflects that. But he says when we isolate ourselves from different perspectives, it becomes difficult to combat polarization.
And the further apart you get, or the more you ignore that middle ground or establish that middle ground as a negative, the more difficult bringing the two parties or the two, you know, political beliefs together becomes.
Conservative Move's Paul Chabot has a quick response to any criticism.
Hey, look, we're providing a service to anybody. We don't ask about your political affiliation. But if you're fed up with the leftist policies that make it difficult for you to have the quality of life, or more importantly, to reach the American dream, which has been owning your own piece of land or property, then, you know, come to us. We'll do all we can.
It's hard to say how well that pitch is working. The company doesn't release financials, but Chabot says it's been a profitable 3 years. He does estimate that his company has helped tens of thousands of families. Of course, he only makes a profit if that interaction results in the sale or purchase of a house. Back in Wyoming, April Poli says she's only fielded phone calls over the last year, but she says she tries to give people a realistic impression of the state.
Maybe they're tired of fighting and they think, well, if we move to a place like Wyoming, we don't have to fight politically. It's just a red state, and I don't really feel like that's true.
Poli says if Wyoming is to stay a red state, conservatives can't rest on their laurels. After all, she says there are purple, even blue spots here. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll hear about efforts to protect the Casper Aquifer. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Tech startups are moving into our region, but as the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck found, there are some hurdles to keeping them around.
Denver, Salt Lake, and Boise are regularly listed among the top 10 cities for new tech startups. Should California start worrying?
We're not going to be the next Silicon Valley. It's not going to happen.
That's Nick Krabs. He's part of the tech startup Vinyl, which has its largest office in Boise and develops software products. And he's right. The entire Mountain West got less than 3% of what California got in venture capital in 2018. But the Mountain West's small tech sector is growing fast, and Krabs says it has something going for it.
What we might be, though, is Boise, Idaho has gotten really cool, right? Bozeman, Montana has gotten really cool, and they have a flavor of this kind of growth there.
Krabs says Boise hardly had any resources for tech startups a few years ago, but it now supports a bustling tech community with co-working spaces, a university business incubator, and a massive yearly event called Boise Startup Week. He's one of the co-chairs.
It's a big reason why we're seeing the success we are.
He says some people move here for the outdoor recreation or to pay lower rent, but he says entrepreneurs really need a supportive entrepreneurial community and a trained workforce. And it's in these areas our region has struggled. He says when it comes to the workforce,
the solution is you know, more investment education and earlier in the pipeline.
Angela Hemingway agrees.
Students sometimes in K-12 may not even have awareness of opportunities that exist in their communities in Idaho or even the world as a whole.
Hemingway leads the STEM Action Center. It's a group funded by state and private dollars that helps Idaho students access a STEM education. On this day, she's at an Idaho Capital event to get kids interested in science, technology, engineering, and math. The kids are checking out robots, wearing VR headsets, and stacking blocks. She says over the last 2 years, her group's led an initiative to get more K-12 students computer savvy, and it's been a success.
We have seen an 11% increase in the number of teachers teaching computer science at the secondary level, so grades 6 through 12. Corresponding, we have seen an 18% increase in the number of students taking computer science.
But it's not all good. There's still a growing gap in STEM jobs and people available to fill them. She says there were more than 7,600 vacancies in Idaho last year, 21% more than the year before. That's partly because many techie kids leave our region. Take Wyoming. Here's Tyler Lindholm, a state representative there.
We invest a huge amount of money in every student that goes to one of our schools.
That is about $16,500 per K-12 student per year. And then the state chips in to fund many Wyoming students' college educations, giving full-ride scholarships to high performers or those in need.
The problem is that not every one of those kids that goes through our education system wants to be a cowboy or a coal miner when they grow up.
So Lindholm has been trying to capture some of the newest kinds of tech startup so kids have more options to stay, namely those involving blockchain technology. That's the stuff behind cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. The state has passed more than a dozen laws to entice blockchain businesses, and Lindholm intends to pass even more. And he's looking at other cutting-edge markets like artificial intelligence. After all, he says, our region is used to exploring new frontiers.
It wasn't Wall Street that won the West. It was, you know, it was cowboys.
Lindholm hopes his own kids want to stay in the cattle ranching business.
But, you know, if that's not for them and they wanted to work in the tech world, hopefully dad's efforts provided more opportunities.
Back in Idaho, Nick Krabs has helped expand that massive annual event, Boise Startup Week. Now that week is not just about supporting startups, it's also about bussing in college computer science students from all over the state to show them just how cool Boise is.
And we put them in concerts and do all kinds of fun stuff with them, and then they go and meet all the technology employers here in Boise. And the statistics from that are staggering. We're seeing like 30% of them who had not previously thought Boise was on their radar getting a job and moving here.
Between the concerts, restaurant tokens, and employment opportunities, he says it shows them just how great their life could be if they stay in the Mountain West. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
A lot of the water that Wyomingites drink comes from the same source, the Casper Aquifer. In many areas, the aquifer is deep underground, but in some areas like the one east of Laramie in the southeast corner of the state, it surfaces. And those areas can be the source of major controversy. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel explains.
The Casper Aquifer supplies all of the city of Laramie's drinking water. It's located to the east of the city and even runs under a good part of it.
All right, so now we are just, we're now coming up. Those layers are coming up underneath us.
That's Byrne Hinckley. He's a hydrogeologist in Laramie who's done a lot of research on the Casper Aquifer formation. He took me out to show me just how much of the aquifer is under the town. And it was kind of shocking. In the Wendy's parking lot in the middle of town, he showed me an area where the aquifer is just under our feet.
The sound of digging away at the Satanka shale in its frozen condition, but you can still see how fine-grained it is.
The protective rock layer over the aquifer, the Satanka shale, bursts out of the ground under all the roads and streets zigzagging past us. But that rock gets thinner as you head down the main drag and out of town towards the interstate. It's not long before you hit what's called the Aquifer Protection Overlay Zone, or APOZ.
So this is this deck of cards that's just stacked up like this, and they're coming to the surface here where we can see them. If you were to put something on the ground here or in this valley, it would soak immediately into these very soft sandstones.
That soft sandstone is incredibly absorbent, which means the aquifer soaks up anything liquid, whether it's rain or even chemicals like gasoline. Now, I've always pictured an aquifer as a big lake under the ground, but that's only half right. An aquifer is an area of rock with lots of pores or spaces. Water, or any other liquid, soaks in and collects there. It can then be sucked out by a well, which means that chemicals can easily get into the drinking water. That's why a lot of activities are limited on the protection zone. The aquifer is only 75 feet or less from the surface, so only certain kinds of businesses can be built here, and they have to follow strict regulations. But the Tumbleweed gas station is a unique case. The Tumbleweed was built before the protection zone was established. It was allowed to remain in business under the condition that it didn't expand. But it recently changed ownership. Manjeet Pander, the new owner of the Tumbleweed gas station, isn't happy with the way the Environmental Advisory Committee designated the Aquifer Protection Overlay Zone in 2002.
You know, I don't know if they were not educated enough. I have no idea why they did it. If you're going to choose an APOS, why they chose a spot, there is a gas station already. I mean, EPA says no gas station. But then they say, nope, that's where we got to draw the water from.
Pander says he takes his business's location on the APOS very seriously, and he feels he's taken a lot of steps to minimize the possible impact of the station.
I'm a human being. I like people being environmental friendly, you know, and I am environmental friendly. And that's the reason I bought the station. Instead of running it, we decided to put $500,000 into it and, you know, make sure that it's safe. I wanted to make sure that what we bought, it's okay.
If the gas tank leaks or the dry cleaner has an accident, it would go straight into the ground, straight into the aquifer.
That's hydrogeologist Hinckley again. He says this is why it's important that these types of businesses aren't built here. He's participated in the Albany County Clean Water Advocates fighting for these protections for years. Now he's working on another effort, the Pilot Hill Project, to protect the aquifer by turning the whole mountainside into a state park. The idea is to protect the area from any future construction. But recently, Albany County commissioners rezoned some land known as the Sweckard property next to the Tumbleweed gas station, and that's causing community members to start protesting all over again. According to Hinckley, the historically drawn boundary of the zone and the actual area where there's sufficient protection over the aquifer don't agree in a few places. He says some places don't have enough protection, but still aren't included in the historically drawn-out boundary found on maps. The Sweckard property is one of those places.
Since 1998, we have learned a lot more about the aquifer, and geologists like myself point out that the line that captures the 75 feet criteria is actually probably 60% of the way across this piece. It's a question of whether it's just this little corner where that car's going by versus 60%.
There are currently no plans for what will be built on the property, but it is for sale. Vi Motes lives next to the Tumbleweed and the Sweckard property. She understands that the gas station is grandfathered in.
I don't mind the gas station there, as long as they're following all the laws.
But she's not so sure about allowing new businesses on the aquifer.
I guess the main thing is that we are so concerned that everyone who lives out there, I hope that they really are truly, truly aware of how serious it is to not protect what is there, not just for now, but for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.
Albany County commissioners have been getting a lot of pushback after changing the zoning to allow commercial development on the Sweckard property. They say they expect the issue will go to district court. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
When we come back, we'll look at how one former coal capital diversified its economy and Cathedral Home prepares young people for the real world. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The coal capital of the U.S. is taking a harder look at diversifying its economy. The city of Gillette is being forced to adjust to a world with less demand for its resource. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports a former coal capital could help provide some wisdom.
In the early 20th century, Rock Springs was a critical provider of coal for the railroad company Union Pacific. The power-producing resource brought the town's population from 40 people to 10,000.
Everybody was working. The mines were running full blast.
That's Jay Lyon, who grew up in Rock Springs. He says most of the locals were immigrants who came there for the job. Lyon remembers a bustling community, big celebratory wine fests, folks cooking out on their lawns. But by the 1950s, Union Pacific began to switch from coal to diesel.
They were using less and less coal, and they were only working sometimes one day a week, sometimes 3 days a week. It's hard to get by on that amount of money.
Soon enough, the mines closed and employment dropped off. Lyon says it was brutal for a lot of families who had nowhere else to go. The federal government had to provide food. He remembers kids in his class going hungry.
There was an expression then that you could shoot a cannon down Broadway or the main street in Rock Springs and not hit anybody.
And soon, the county was littered with ghost towns. Mark Haggerty with the research group Headwaters Economics says one industry towns are inherently vulnerable.
The real effort that needs to take place is trying to diversify and reach out and branch out into new sectors, into new ideas that will sustain the community going forward.
Diversification is far from a new concept in Wyoming, but it's easier said than done. Haggerty explains it's especially tough in Wyoming, where the state relies on taxes derived from minerals like coal. He says most of the successful rural transitions happen when they become more like a small city, has the major assets that attract people to the community, are close to metropolitan areas or recreational opportunities.
And for those places that don't have those other assets, an airport, a university, or a national park, we really don't have a lot of lessons for them because there have not been a lot of successful transitions.
And Rock Springs did avoid becoming a ghost town, though not through diversification in the traditional sense. Many coal miners went on to work in Trona, the gritty component of toothpaste and baking soda, which happened to be in the region. Oil and gas then became very profitable, which led to a huge growth in population, development of a college, restaurants, other businesses.
If we wouldn't have been located in an area that was blessed with such a vast amount of marketable resources, it would be a different story for sure.
That's the current mayor of Rock Springs, Tim Como, who says good-paying jobs did a lot for the community. But it hasn't escaped them from the boom-bust economy quite yet. Como says the town is looking into diversification itself because of the early closure of its coal plant. That takes us to Gillette. Like Rock Springs once did, the area is pushing hard to figure out a path forward while leaning on natural resources too, like coal and natural gas. Employment, though, in coal mining has dropped by a fifth since 2013. Next year, coal production is expected to drop by 25% of 2018 levels. While Campbell County Commissioner Rusty Bell says it's necessary to diversify the local economy, he adds it is not easy.
Because we didn't start this, or an industry didn't start this, honestly, 20, 25 years ago, thinking about, hey, what else can we do with this besides just ship it out of here and burn it in somebody's power plant?
He says there are many projects in the works to look into new ways to use that coal. And that hopefully will create a new kind of innovation hub that'll attract new business and be part of the solution. But in the meantime, Bell says Wyoming needs to take a look at reforming its tax structure, because he says the reliance on fossil fuels makes it hard for towns like Gillette to just diversify.
I think it's pressing because Wyoming's tax structure is set up that if we're not taking minerals out of the ground, Wyoming's state tax structure fails, honestly.
Like the coal capital before it that faced a tough road and thrived, Bell says he's confident Gillette can do that too. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
One of the difficult things for children who are placed in group homes is how to manage when they leave that setting. It used to be that when those 18-year-olds left the group home, they would essentially have to fend for themselves. In Laramie, Cathedral Home for Children has a program that tries to help young people navigate the so-called real world. A version of Cathedral Home for Children has been in Laramie for over 100 years. It deals with children who have had to leave their homes, like Dustin. He entered the program at the age of 15 and admits he was a handful.
You know, at the time, I was always just so hard-headed that I didn't want to do certain things. And even though I needed to do them, I would either learn the hard way or the easy way. So,
Dustin left and returned to Cathedral Home three times until he was 18. And graduated out of the program. In the past, these young people would face the world essentially on their own. Marketing Director Cassidy Biggs says those who come to Cathedral Home have a variety of challenges.
We work with kids that have dealt with extensive trauma, such as, you know, drug abuse, drug addiction. They've experienced abuse, physical, emotional. A lot of them have been neglected. A lot of them have experienced abandonment.
Big says the children are given a treatment plan and typically spend 6 to 9 months at the facility. Some return home, but if home is not safe, they might stay longer or end up in a foster home. Sometimes they come back. The goal is to try and get children counseling support and other types of treatment so they can begin fitting into society. Some of the teens, like Dustin, will essentially go directly from Cathedral Home to living alone. Most of us have parents that will train us for that time in our lives. We can return home, and when we want to, we can even borrow money. But group home kids don't always have that safety net. So Big says they start preparing them as soon as possible.
We start that transition plan before it's even a notion that they're going to be out on their own. We work with them from early on in their placement in our residential treatment program to kind of identify what we can foresee being a need once they go out on their own.
Big says they try to cover a wide range of issues.
To help find jobs, we help them to find places to live. We teach them how to go shopping, how to do the everyday daily tasks.
Misty Langwell is the program's extended families coordinator. Her job is to oversee the effort to teach those young people how to take the next step.
We're teaching them skills to be able to communicate with others, get jobs, work on their hygiene, all kinds of things.
Langwell says they get into rental agreements, buying cars, how to make do if your budget doesn't balance. Unlike the past, they can provide some financial help if someone gets into a bind, and certainly can provide advice. But the goal is to get the person mentally ready to move on with the rest of their life.
Help them identify what their needs are, what their strengths are, and what they want their life to look like. So, not everybody's life is perfect, and so we want to help them so it's perfect for them.
We mentioned Dustin earlier in the story. While he's excited to strike out on his own, he admits it was daunting to leave the structure of Cathedral Home, especially since he's had to overcome some temptations in the past.
It was definitely hard to transition from being, in facilities, because I was in a facility, not just Cathedral Home, but a number of different places from 14 to 18.
But so far, so good.
I am currently a Cap 2 stocker at Walmart, and I am trying to get everything situated for entering back into my HISET, which is the new word for GED classes these days.
Dustin says the plan is to eventually go to college. Cassidy Biggs of Cathedral Home admits she gets a little emotional when she thinks about the great odds some of these young people have had to overcome.
They have a lot of trauma. They deal with a lot of emotional instability. They deal with a lot of hardship, tumultuous relationships that, continue to be a component of their life. And I think that's a lot of stuff to deal with on top of having to figure out how to pay rent, how to get a job, how to go out and be self-sufficient.
That's why it's such a thrill watching them succeed. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. A recent incident of a dog dying after getting caught in a snare has some Fremont County residents changing their dog walking habits and calling for increased restrictions on trapping. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
Karen Zoller's two rescue dogs, Macy and Izza, love to run and explore. So she takes them to trails like this one in the Shoshone National Forest, where she can let them off leash. But lately, she's had to be careful when she takes her dogs out on public land.
So is this a place where you would worry about traps?
Good question.
About a month ago, Zoller was running on a trail north of Ocean Lake, just outside of Pavilion, with her one-year-old mutt named Mac.
Mac. I found him on the side of the road. He was just a mix, but he was a medium size. His ears pointed up. He looked a little, I don't know, some lab qualities. Just cute. Just the sweetest thing. Kind-hearted.
Zoller and Mac were running along when Mac strayed off the trail a bit.
And then, boom, I saw Mac's body flip.
So she ran over to him and saw that his neck had been caught in a snare.
And I find him, and it was a neck snare, and I couldn't get it, and he's in respiratory distress, and I was trying to undo the snare, and he was just going down, and he died right in my arms, and I couldn't do anything.
Zoller called her husband. They couldn't get the snare to release, so they had to load Mac's body into their truck with the snare still attached. They called the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. An officer came and did an investigation.
Looked at the situation and looked at the snare, took some pictures, and said that everything is legal.
In Wyoming, you need a license and a permit to trap or snare animals on public land. But you don't have to tell anyone what kind of trap you're using or even where you're putting it. And there's no buffer zone around popular hiking trails. The day after Mac died, Zoller posted on a local Facebook group about what happened. Debate ensued and some outrage. Lots of people said they weren't aware that traps were a risk on popular hiking trails. In response, the Lander Game and Fish Office organized a workshop to teach people how to release a trap or snare if their pet gets caught in one. Local trapper Alan Sinner volunteered to lead the workshop.
The dog comes up, sniffs it, gets hit. Okay, don't panic. Just work fast.
But it wasn't an easy job. Some people were more interested in debating trapping regulations.
I'd like to stay on track with the trap release thing. I really would. If that's okay. I mean, can we all just kind of cool down a little bit? I mean, I'm more than, you know, is that okay with everybody? Can we kind of move on to the trap part? Okay.
Tonight is about learning to release.
Yeah, that's what I want to do.
Eventually, Sinner starts to show people how to release traps. He passes around different kinds of snares, and folks practice snapping them with wire cutters.
Now
a few people try pressing down on the levers of a foothold trap.
Use your feet. Get closer to the trap. Then push down on the
lever. Carefully might bite you.
There you go.
Phil Pfister was there representing the Wyoming Trappers Association, which co-sponsored the workshop. He says if you're going to walk your dog on public land in Wyoming, especially without a leash, it's your responsibility to learn how to release a trap.
When everybody is doing their due diligence, I think things can be taken different and can be handled differently as well without regulations.
Out in the parking lot, he introduces me to his own dog.
So this is Franklin.
Come on,
Hi,
get out.
Franklin.
Yeah, that's my trapping dog.
When I ask about how he keeps Franklin safe while he's out setting traps, Pfister reaches into a seat back pocket and pulls out a leash.
One thing I like to do is live by example.
One thing Pfister doesn't want to see is any changes to trapping regulations. But since Mac's death, a group in Fremont County has been talking about doing just that. They've been writing letters, making phone calls, but the Game and Fish Commission isn't scheduled to sit down and review Wyoming's trapping regulations until 2022. For now, folks are arming themselves with heavy-duty wire cutters and as much preventative education as possible. A month after losing her dog, Karen Zoller is glad for that silver lining, but she says running with her dogs will never be quite the same.
You get this sense of living in fear, and it's like, you know, I don't want to sit in my house and live in fear, so I have to take those baby steps, and you know, we went back to the lake. Of course, I don't want to go alone. So me and my husband, we actually have the wire cutters every time because you don't know if snares are out there.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr in Lander.
When we come back, we will get an update on a ski area that's returned to northeastern Wyoming, and it's another edition of our Belonging series. This is Open Spaces. You are enjoying Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This winter season is the first time since 2004 that the Antelope Butte Mountain Recreation Area is fully open. The effort to reopen the ski area located in the Bighorn Mountains took two communities separated by a mountain range over the last decade. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska has the story.
It's an unusually warm Saturday at the Antelope Butte Mountain Recreation Area. Elevation 9,400 feet, located in the middle of the Bighorn Mountain Range between Grable and Sheridan. I'm at the top of the ski hill. An avid skier, I start down a powdery run with evergreens and big boulders surrounding me.
Are you ready?
Yep.
At the bottom, I meet Lynette Sutphin. Sutphin is here with her two young daughters.
I skied back in the early to late 90s. Before I went to college up in Montana, I learned to ski here.
She left the area for a while and then moved to Bighorn. And when she did, she learned that her old ski hill closed down due to a legal matter.
just disappointing to lose places like this. I actually prefer smaller mountains. It's like a community. You know, you come up and you see people you know every weekend, and your kids always bump into their friends. You know the runs real well.
And it's the community that brought the mountain back after 15 years. Mark Weitz is the secretary of the Antelope Butte Foundation.
We saw in late 2010 an article in the Sheridan Press that said their Forest Service is considering salvage operations, which means tear this all out. And so a group of citizens got together and said, what are we going to do about this?
The communities of Sheridan and Grable formed a foundation and started fundraising right away.
Anything from t-shirt and bake sales all the way to having large foundations and large donors help us out.
They were able to buy the National Forest permit, but there were hiccups along the way, like making sure the old equipment, like the lifts, worked and were safe. Foundation President Jeff Grant says the foundation members were slightly surprised how nostalgic people were about the ski hill and how important it was to them to get the hill up and running again.
We want to go back to being a really important asset to both sides of the mountain and build those same memories and those same connections that led to, like, somebody like Mark getting a job offer, riding a chairlift here. I mean, that kind of blows your mind to think that that's the role this place had.
The foundation realizes it's not easy to keep a place like Antelope Butte running. This is the first year the hill is fully operational, and another small nonprofit ski hill just east of Cody, Sleeping Giant, announced this will be the last winter season it's open. The reason is financial. But Grant says Antelope Butte lift ticket sales have been strong.
Antelope Butte used to do 11,000. Well, we expect to be back at that level and beyond because of the population growth on the Sheridan side of the mountain. So we feel like 10, 11, 12,000 and above is where we're going to be, and that's going to prevent what happened at Sleeping Giant.
Sleeping Giant officials say they only sold half that number of lift tickets. Grant says it may be because it's at the end of a dead-end road in the winter, while Antelope Butte sits on the main artery between two communities. The original reason Antelope Butte closed was not financial, it was personal. In addition to winter visitors being at a higher level than the conservative estimates this season, Antelope Butte is open during the summertime as well.
Two things that we do annually. One is the summer festival. The last weekend in June, we have a brew fest up here. This will be our fourth or fifth one. What we do beyond that, that requires bigger investments like building mountain bike trails and all that, that's to be determined what we do.
So far, the winter season is going swell. They have sold more tickets than their conservative estimate, and for Lynette Sutphin's two girls, Lillian and Leah, it's a blast.
It's so much fun up here, and today was my first time on the big lift, and it was so much fun.
And this is what Antelope Butte hopes to achieve, bringing back skiing and snowboarding to the Grable and Sheridan communities. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Gadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Destiny and Taylor are both 17 years old and from Rock Springs. Both were also residents at the Wyoming Girls School in 2019. They say their experiences in the state have been shaped by their town and the struggle to get out from behind judgments. For our Belonging series, the two sat down to discuss how their experiences in and outside of Rock Springs will shape the way they think about the community as they move into adulthood. First, Destiny shares how her past has affected her view of her hometown.
Honestly, I never felt like I belonged in Rock Springs. There's a lot of drug use and bullying and definitely, like, just bad things that I never wanted to be a part of. You make one mistake and then it's spread across the whole community.
Yeah, I definitely feel like it limits you being able to start over and start with a fresh slate, because everyone where I'm from now knows I got sent to the girls' school and I was arrested. They know, like, my track record, but they don't know exactly what I've learned and they don't know what I want to accomplish. I don't think it's a good environment for me, especially if I want to stay sober and, like, continue my recovery. Has the girls' school changed your perspective on what community means to you?
I definitely think being sent 7 hours away from your hometown can, like, change your perspective on it a lot. I think I belong more here than I have anywhere else, which is sad in a way, but I used to not even want to have friends anymore because of all the things I've been through, but now I kind of see that there's all kinds of people in this world, and like, we all go through things.
I feel like once I opened up, I definitely have done a lot of self-reflection here, and I've done a lot of opening up and like seeing new things and meeting new people, and I think it's been really good for me. What, if anything, are there qualities from the girls' school that you want to look for in communities or take with you?
I think I would look for people who are sober, a sober community to be in. Also, respect is a big thing for me. I've talked about it a lot. I just think that, community should be welcoming of each other, and I need better friends and support. So I think that's what I'm going to look for in my next community.
We have this poster in our dorm, and it says all sizes, all shapes, all colors, everything. And I feel like that's definitely a big thing here. Like, it's not just a poster that you see on the wall. It's definitely shown, and you can see that everybody's really accepting of who you are and what you've been through, and they don't just look at your record or anything and decide from there. What's on paper really doesn't matter here because they give you a chance to be a part of this community, so I think it's really great.
I think I definitely learned just to respect people for who they are, because I would never want someone to feel the way I did in a community, just so, like, shamed and unloved. So I definitely took that away, but I also think there's good parts of Wyoming that I would want, like the nature.
I definitely feel like what I've been through in this state is pulling me away from it, and I don't know, I want to travel and I want to see new things, and yeah, I'm definitely not going to stay here forever, but I don't know, based on everything you have experienced, do you think you want to stay in Wyoming?
I might come back to visit, but I don't think I'd ever live here, like, willingly. It's just not my cup of tea. I don't know.
I guess everywhere you go, you'll find people that are really great for you and, like, people that you just don't click with, but I don't know. I feel like it's a really pretty state, and it depends on who you are, but it's not for me.
Now, StoryCorps. Daniel Haskell grew up in South Carolina, where he developed a love of kayaking. When StoryCorps came to Jackson recently, he told facilitator Kevin Oliver sometimes the water could be dangerous.
My mom got a little freaked out when I would do water sports. The kayaking was the one that really got her, especially for creek boating, which is a low-volume river. You've got very narrow rivers you're running, lots of rocks, potentially trees. You really have to be on your game on those. One mistake could potentially cost you. And it wasn't until I moved out to Wyoming years later that I told her about two instances where I was pinned. And one of those, I didn't think I was going to survive.
Can you tell us what pin means?
It could be an undercut rock that sort of has an overhang, and you get pushed underneath it, and because of the way the current's pushing, it holds you there. Or it could be a tree in the water called a strainer. And I experienced an undercut rock and a strainer, both of which, last minute, I was able to get out. The tree, I kind of had to force myself out of my boat and then climb through this tree underwater, which I was lucky I could do. You know, I was kind of out of options at that time. I had been underwater for who knows how long. And the undercut rock, it was purely happenstance. I was able to get out of that. My back was against the rock, and I was kind of laying forward. The kayak, the bottom of it, was on the side that the current was pressing up against. So I truly had no way to have any strength to push myself or anything. I was just wedged in there, and my boat was kind of rocking. It just happened that on one of those rocks, it knocked the boat loose, and I was able to get out. The wildest thing was the guys I was with said that their hair pretty much stood up on end. They said I had been underwater for about a minute or so. The sound, they said, of me gasping for air when I first surfaced, it was just very eerie, they were saying, because they kind of assumed the worst.
What was going through your head during that time?
The first is automatically fear. And the other thing, surprisingly, was it was very therapeutic for me. Not only did I not want to let my parents down, but I also kind of gained a value of wanting to have an accomplished life. You know, I want to have experiences, and especially those in the outdoors, while also understanding that with life comes responsibility. And I ended out in Wyoming. So coming out here has allowed me to progress even more in a lot of hobbies and activities I never thought I would. The whitewater rafting, scenic rafting, mountain biking, lots of hiking. That's where those experiences back east really helped moving to an area like this.
What keeps you going back, and what do you take away from these experiences in nature?
The biggest thing is respect. You obviously have great spirit experiences. It's very beautiful, but with respect, you understand that you are nothing. Though I love and admire my time being in nature, I also carry a huge respect for the things that can level you out in nature.
That's Daniel Haskell at StoryCorps in Jackson. Greg Ronco produced this piece. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This program and all of our segments can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can find past shows and sign up for our podcast on that site as well. Just look for Open Spaces, or you can get the podcast at all the usual places. Our stories are also available on our Facebook page and via Twitter. Anna Rader is our web editor. Please support this program with your pledge of support. All you've got to do is go to our website to see how. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.